from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. There were harsh words from a number of regional sources in Latin America and the Caribbean Tuesday after President Obama issued Monday's executive order designating the government of Venezuela as a threat to U.S. national security. This was Ernesto Samper, the Secretary General of the Union of South American Nations, or UNASUR, on Monday, less than a week after a delegation of senior officials from that organization visited Caracas.
El Consejo de Cancilleres de UNASUR.
The Council of Ministers of UNASUR appointed the foreign ministers of Ecuador, Colombia, and Brazil so they could represent the Union on different approaches regarding Venezuela. And so, in this regard, and with the participation of the pro-tempore presidency of Uruguay, we accepted the invitation made by President Nicolas Maduro this past Friday, and we'll go back to Venezuela to closely examine the situation which our sister country faces.
More Latin American countries rallied behind Venezuela Tuesday to condemn new U.S. sanctions against the South American nation. The Cuban government slammed the U.S. sanctions as arbitrary and aggressive. A statement issued in the newspaper Granma asked, quote, "How is Venezuela a threat to the United States? Thousands of kilometers away, without strategic weapons and without the resources to conspire against the U.S. constitutional order, the White House declaration has little credibility," closed quote. Earlier in the day, Bolivia's President Evo Morales said the regional blocs CELAC and UNASUR should immediately hold an emergency meeting, arguing that the U.S. sanctions pose a threat to all of Latin America and the Caribbean. UNASUR's head and other regional leaders, including Ecuador's President Rafael Correa, have already slammed the White House's decision to impose more sanctions on Venezuela. The latest move was seen as part of an ongoing assault against the Venezuelan government, couched in the cover of the language of human rights, but actually targeting the nation's sovereignty. Telesur's Andrea Hall reports from Washington.
It began with broad sanctions in December against Venezuelan officials. Now the Obama administration has declared the country poses a national security threat to the United States and produced a list of sanctioned individuals.
Obviously, there are certain individuals who met the criteria to be named on this list. And this gives the president the authority, moving forward, if needed, to name additional individuals.
So far, seven Venezuelan officials will no longer be allowed to enter the United States nor do business with American firms. Surprising news for activists who have been following the situation since early last year.
Declaring a national emergency for national security of the U.S. about what's going on in Venezuela, that just really doesn't make any sense.
The executive order issued on Monday implements and further expands upon the Venezuelan Defense of Human Rights and Civil Society Act of 2014. The U.S. government says those named undermine democratic institutions, were involved in political corruption, or suppressed human rights and expression.
It's very, very broad what they can say. I mean, when you include corruption, I think that you could apply that standard to almost any country in the world, including the United States. And the author of the sanctions bill, Bob Menendez, he's being indicted for corruption.
The announcement comes just over a week after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced new visa requirements for U.S. travelers to Venezuela and barred U.S. officials like Menendez and Dick Cheney from acquiring visas to the country.
The main threat is the power and the influence they have over other countries that are trying to find their place in the political spectrum, and that this country fears the influence that Venezuela has on those other countries.
Meanwhile, Foreign Minister Delcy Rodriguez declared on Twitter that Venezuela's government has called for immediate consultations with its highest diplomat in the United States. Alexandra Hall, Telesur, Washington.
The open letter that 47 Senate Republicans sent to Iran's leadership Monday, warning about making a nuclear agreement with President Obama, has caused waves both in Washington and Tehran. Press TV's Reza Golzadeh filed this report.
The political chasm in the United States between President Barack Obama and Republican lawmakers over an impending deal on Iran's nuclear program appears to be widening. 47 Republican senators in an open letter to Iran have emphasized that any nuclear deal between the U.S. administration and Iran will be ineffective unless it has the seal of Congress. They say the next U.S. president could revoke any nuclear deal that Obama signs with Iran and that future Congresses could modify its terms at any time. And this is already being seen as an effort by the lawmakers to undermine Obama in talks over the Iranian nuclear program.
Well, it is to undermine Obama, but it does raise a very serious constitutional and legal question on the American side. The fact is, Mr. Obama has a long history of playing fast and loose with his constitutional authority at the expense of Congress, even worse than other presidents have done. Now, there is something of a dilemma here. If he does not submit this to the Senate as a treaty, yes, it would only be in force while he is president and easily could be revoked by the next president. On the other hand, if he did submit it as a treaty, 47 senators is more than enough to block it in the Senate.
In reaction to the senator's letter, Iran's foreign minister said it's devoid of any legal value and is simply a propaganda stunt. Now, a look at the current course of political events in the U.S. may show that the letter of the Republicans is mostly a warning to Obama rather than a message to Iran. This has added to the already existing skepticism over whether the current political leaders in the United States can be reliable negotiating partners.
This damages the U.S. credibility in the world. The United States cannot make a decision at home, let alone at international level. This will also confuse other partners and other parties in the negotiations. Most notably, the Iranians will definitely be confused by this.
The letter of the Republican senators has made the White House to react, warning that such efforts could derail talks on Iran's nuclear program. The White House described the letter as the continuation of a partisan strategy to undermine Obama's ability to conduct his foreign policy strategy. The controversy comes at a time when Iran nuclear talks have already reached a crucial stage toward a final agreement. Yet Monday's controversial letter shows that the Republicans are becoming more vocal in their opposition to a potential Iran deal, what will, of course, appease Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the first place.
The ceasefire in Ukraine continues to hold, but the toll on the people in the eastern part of the country is only now being properly tallied. Derek Mbata reports from the United Nations.
The UN Refugee Agency said that conditions in northern Donetsk and Luhansk are particularly dire. The supply of water and electricity was often disrupted by shelling and rocket attacks, it added. William Spindler is UNHCR spokesperson in Geneva.
Heavy shelling resulting in civilian deaths continues to be reported, especially around the town of Debaltseve, which was the scene of heavy fighting in February. The fighting makes the delivery of humanitarian aid to the many civilians trapped in the conflict areas extremely difficult. The scarcity of basic supplies, including food, fuel, and medicines, has driven up prices of available supplies.
Despite the security risks, UNHCR and its partners have delivered emergency assistance to some of the neediest civilians, including in areas under frequent bombardment. For the first time, the agency reached two areas in Luhansk, Novopskov and Markivka, which were until now inaccessible to humanitarian agencies. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
China has announced a 10% increase in its military budget for 2015 to an estimated $150 billion. CCTV's Han Bin reports from Beijing.
China's lawmakers from the armed forces. They come from the top think tanks and key commanders. It's no surprise to them that many point to the country's yearly defense budget increase as evidence of a threat. But these MPC deputies say the military spending is in line with the economic growth and national defense needs.
We think China's defense budget increase is moderate and reasonable. Although the rise in the past years has surpassed GDP growth, China's military expenditure in 2015 accounts for less than 1.3% of GDP, well below the world average of 2-4%.
Chen Zhou is the key expert in the making many of China's defense white papers. It has an informed understanding of the real situation of the PLA. He explains that the budget is earmarked equally for three parts: personnel, training and maintenance, and equipment. The Major General says the double-digit increase is also to compensate for the serious underinvestment that has haunted the PLA since the 1980s. And in the 21st century, the army is in a key phase of informationization and mechanization, as well as deepening reform. It also has to expand development in new fields like space and cybersecurity. All this requires money, lots of it.
To achieve the country's security strategy, to protect the country's sovereignty and national interests, and to meet new challenges, China needs to increase its defense budget.
China believes it is under constant strategic pressure with rising maritime risks, territorial disputes, and terrorism threats. Some would argue its military expenditure is still far from what's needed to deal with increasing severe security challenges. The government has laid out the policy of building a solid national defense and strong armed forces. At the same time, it seeks to take on more international responsibilities in which the PLA plays a key role.
China's official military spending is much less than many of the major powers, but it's still raising concerns from the rest of the world. The military's aim is to improve conditions for the armed forces amidst the rising costs and greater competition. Along with its economic growth, the country's military spending is likely to continue to rise in the future. Han Bin, CCTV, Beijing.
That $150 billion budget compares to the 2015 U.S. military budget, which totaled nearly $1 trillion, with $613.9 billion for national defense and overseas contingency operations, and $151 billion for veterans' benefits and services, among other listed items. Russia is looking warily at a series of military exercises with U.S. and NATO troops taking place along its borders from Norway in the north all the way to the Black Sea in the south. We have this report from RT.
The United States has started the deployment of 3,000-strong units of its infantry to the Baltics to hold a three-month exercise with Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia. Latvia has also confirmed more than 120 armored units, including tanks, have been delivered by the United States. Now, I'm joined by James Jatris, former advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for joining us here on RT International. What do you think, then, is the actual purpose of these drills?
It's saber-rattling. It's a show of force to reiterate the American political commitment to defend the Baltic states under Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty. The irony is, of course, is that 3,000 troops are nowhere sufficient to defend these countries if there really were a threat to them, which there is not. The only way they could actually be defended would be through a nuclear threat, in effect exchanging Chicago to defend Narva, which I don't think most Americans would be in favor of if they knew even where Narva was.
Well, you've touched, sorry to interrupt, James, you touched on it there. Do you think that the fears within some in the Baltic nations of a possible Russian invasion are in any way justified?
No, I do not think so. I think this is, again, just a show of force, and partly it exposes NATO's and Washington's impotence over events in Ukraine. Now that we see much more that the Europeans seem to be decoupling their policy from Washington's guidance, I think there's a sense of frustration that our hold over European security through NATO is somewhat in danger. So again, this is a political show even more than a military show.
There is a great deal of misunderstanding between the peoples of Russia and the United States, much of it a consequence of the news coverage received here in the West. Charles Bousman is the editor and publisher of Russia Insider, an online news magazine at www.russia-insider.com, which was started in September of last year by a group of expatriates living in Russia who felt that coverage of that country was biased and grossly inaccurate. Bousman speaks Russian and German. We spoke with him in American English via Skype from Moscow Monday. Russia Insider is a few months old now. A lot of content, tons, and from voices all over the world. Maybe you could tell us first what you have there and then a little bit about how you guys put this together.
Sure. Well, basically, it's a website that tries to put up a lot of high-quality analytical and news stories about Russia, about the situation in Ukraine, a lot of stuff that isn't getting carried in the mainstream media. And the reason we put it together was because, well, first of all, all of us are non-journalists, the guys who started it. And we're people from all over the world, from the U.S., mostly U.S., Canada, U.K., and then also Western Europe. And, you know, we know Russia well, and many of us have worked here and have a lot of experience here. And last summer, the coverage in the international media about what was going on in the Ukraine was so one-sided and so biased. And really, I mean, I could just run out of superlatives to describe it.
One of them was fantastic.
It was terrible.
Just in terms of being out of sync with the fact, it was literally fantastic.
It was extreme, you know. And I've noticed for years that the coverage of Russia was very biased and tendentious, and it wasn't sort of giving a realistic picture of the country. But it went completely off the charts last summer, and it was a very sort of scary time. I mean, people were thinking, hey, you know, a major war could break out in Europe over this. And so just a small group of us said, look, we just want to put up a very small site, which we honestly thought would be read by about, you know, 20 of our friends, where we just sort of try and sound off and say, look, here, there's some things that are just not true that are being, you know, spread in the mainstream media about what's going on there. And this amazing phenomenon happened. All these people started talking about us on social media, and volunteering and asking to contribute and applauding and saying, you guys are so great, we got to do more of this, and so on and so forth. So we started with literally like 3 or 4 articles a day that we were putting up, and people just kept signing up, showing up, offering to help, and it sort of turned into a sort of a broad-based volunteer movement. It's important to understand this is not a typical news website where it's kind of a top-down thing where, you know, somebody decided to invest money and hire people and put out a lot of content. This is very much a user-generated citizen journalism. I would call it like a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I'm somewhat accidentally the head of an online movement. and, you know, it's a funny place to be in because I'm not a professional journalist. I spent my career in finance.
Right.
But the thing really, really took off. We just kept on putting, as more volunteers showed up, we just kept putting up more material. We got to about 40 headlines a day. Sort of in November. We started it in late September. Our traffic has gone ballistic. And that, for me, is the really interesting thing because we have, you know, a lot of visitors and readers. And I'd like to say that it's because we're so smart and doing such an amazing job. And perhaps there's a grain of truth in that. But what it really tells me is there was a real hunger for this. I mean, there were a lot of people out there who sort of also felt that they weren't getting accurate information from their media about the Russia story. And we just happened to show up at the right time, and the demand was relentless. I mean, relentless. So that's the story. It's an interesting. It's like we took the pulse of news and media consumers out there, and suddenly, you know, we realized, oh my God, there's a huge demand for this kind of stuff.
Mm. You know, I came to Russian media, to looking to Russian media, in particular RT and other media outlets after that. I think really in depth, a little before the war on Cote d'Ivoire and the war on Libya began. And I had been to Libya in late 2009 and saw it with my own eyes. I was there about a week. and had a chance to, I was in Tripoli, so I had a chance really to scope out what Libya was, you know, what it was about, how the people lived, how things worked, you know, all of that. And then when the war started, the characterization of Libya that was presented as fact was so out of whack with my personal experience. And while I was looking for somebody that was reporting on it from the ground, for example, and somewhat accurately, I found that RT was doing that. And I started looking at that every day. And from there, I started looking at other Russian media at the time, Voice of Russia, now Sputnik, these other news agencies, TASS always, and what was RIA Novosti, which is also now Sputnik. And I found this diversity of opinion that was there. There were the right-wing people from the United States and left-wing people from other parts of the world, and Russia no longer is considers itself a left-wing country. This is such a counterintuitive thing for Americans who were taught that, you know, there was one guy in a back room in the Kremlin that published all of the news and information for the entire Soviet Union. So now you have this. How do you see yourself fitting into, like, the whole media picture?
Okay. Well, you mean how do we compare to those state-backed media outlets?
No, more. If you look at the totality of information that's out there, you know, this is what is being presented about what happened today around the world. How do you see yourself fitting in, your niche, the piece, that the thing that's missing that you're filling in?
Okay. I guess what we're trying to get across is we're filling in what the mainstream media is not telling you about Russia, or what we believe they're saying inaccurately. And you could, I'm perfectly comfortable saying, actually, in many cases, dishonestly, consciously,
yeah,
dishonestly.
I agree with that.
And you know, the Russian state-backed media outlets do that too, and they've been doing actually a pretty good job of it. But we're very different from them in the sense that, first of all, we're not Russian, and we're not based in Russia, and we're not funded by Russia. We're a group of volunteers from around the world, and our voice is very American and very, you know, native English speaking. Right. So you get the feeling on our site that, you know, you're talking to your fellow Americans or Brits or Canadians about, you know, what's going on there. And we can get the message across a lot better than the Russian state-backed media can, because, I mean, they're still Russian, and they present things from a, you know, with a Russian voice sometimes, or a Russian mentality, and that's good. They should be doing that, right. And it's needed out there. But it's more convincing and more understandable, and also I think more believable when you're hearing it from your own people, you know, from people that you relate to completely.
Yeah, I mean, looking at your bio, for example, you worked at NBC News in Moscow in the late '80s, which is an interesting.
Yes.
You know, an interesting point of view, that I was watching NBC News in Moscow in the late 80s. And and also, you know, and the media here was very anti-Soviet and anti-Russian during these Reagan years and the early years of Bush. And then you were also did large-scale investments over the last 6-7 years in agriculture. I'm assuming it's there, right? Yeah. So
yes.
You're talking about. I mean, there's. I looked at Russia from when I was a kid. I'm in my early 60s now, as a lefty. You know, I'm feeling some solidarity with the people there, and having an alternate view of U.S.-Soviet relations to the prevailing one here. But it seems to me you go in with NBC, and then you go into agriculture, which used to be, you know, that was a big thing, that it was state agriculture, and now a lot of it's not. And so you're bringing a different perspective as an American to that than mine. And yet there's this diversity of opinion at this website that goes from people left of me to, you know, to people that do corporate work there.
Yeah. No, that's also very interesting that that the appeal of the site seems to be evenly split between people on the left going way over to the progressive left, you know, who are very critical of the U.S., and also then the right and very conservative people, and then tons of people in the middle, obviously. But it seems to have a universal appeal, and what that seems to suggest, I've thought about this, and it's interesting that one thing that everybody can agree on is that the media is doing a terrible job.
Yeah, right.
It's like everybody's agrees that the media isn't suiting them and not giving them what they need to be knowing. And I think it's a fascinating thing. I can tell you very briefly. The other interesting thing about our readership is that they're evenly split between Europe and America, or North America, I guess, including Canada.
Really?
So, you know, we get half our readership from basically UK, Germany, France, and then the other half from US and Canada.
See, for example, going to the spread. What you're presenting that I just described in, you know, bare bones terms, that vast area from, you know, people who criticize Russia from, you know, from a communist left perspective, that, you know, you're no longer a communist country, you've turned capitalist, to people that are active capitalists in Russia, that entire spectrum is missing from the narrative here. And there's only a narrow band that's to the right of the... of the right of that spectrum that's presented to Western Europe and the United States.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, when I look at, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I was, as I said, I was not a journalist 6 months ago, and I'm not sure I'm one now. I don't know what I am. But, you know, I was a businessman who was a news consumer, and I was aware that there was something that I thought was strange about the news, but it wasn't something I could really dig into. Well, in the last 6 months, one of the things we've done as a group, and I've had the chance to discuss it with the other guys on the project, is we've really analyzed these articles and sort of said, what is going on here? I mean, who are these people, and why are they saying these things, and how are they saying them, and how are they sort of skewing and sort of misrepresenting things? And so we've become sort of, in a very short time, in a big hurry, kind of like experts in media analysis or media criticism, trying to understand what was going on, sort of approaching it in a very practical and sort of, you know, open-minded way.
Yeah.
And the conclusion I've come to is that, you know, the media have gone off way out on a limb, and they're pushing an agenda, and it's a very narrow one. And in order to push that agenda, they've got to be very, very selective about the sort of views they present and the facts they present. And they're in a very vulnerable position because they have opened themselves up to massive criticism. I mean, I haven't been able to do 90% of the criticism I want to do about just the New York Times, just what the New York Times has written about the Ukraine over the last year, because I don't have the resources. But I see endless instances of malpractice. It's journalistic malpractice, and it's a disgrace.
And go into that. Okay, so your background actually is in finance, and keeping a website up and getting all this content, making arrangements with people, you know, you have to clear rights, all these other things. You got to finance it. How do you guys finance this?
Well, we've actually spent a really surprisingly small amount of money on this compared to what's up there. And the way that's happened is because we're really a broad-based volunteer movement. 90% of what we've done has been done by volunteers. And then the parts that do have to be paid for, like the web hosting, and we have to pay a programmer here to help us, you know, maintain the site and things like that, we've paid out of our own pockets.
Hmm. So you guys do any fundraising or?
Yeah, well, what we've decided to do, because we've gotten this huge response, and we're like, wow, look, and we get this mail every day that, oh, you guys are wonderful, and please keep it up and do more, and this was so badly needed, and so on. So what we're experimenting now is crowdfunding, and we have a crowdfunding campaign live right now, which we've just started. And it's going to be interesting to see where it goes.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.